This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, U.S. foreign and national security policy priorities and challenges for the incoming administration in 2017. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel, coming to you as we do every year at this time from the campus of Georgetown University right here in Washington, D.C. With less than 2 weeks to go until former reality TV star and billionaire Donald J. Trump takes the oath of America's highest office, many foreign policy experts concede that they still do not know what kind of foreign policy he will oversee. We have some clues from his statements and cabinet nominees, but not a coherent picture. However, one thing is certain among the uncertainty. President-elect Donald Trump's victory is set to usher into the White House a worldview very different from that of President Barack Obama, where a bipartisan consensus prevailed about the importance of maintaining a liberal, rules-based international order. If Mr. Trump stays true to his campaign and post-election rhetoric, we can expect a warming of U.S.-Russian relations. This might mean less support for Ukraine and NATO, and a lessening or outright dismantling of sanctions, any of which would provide a significant boost for Russia's leaders, a view that may conflict with that of many Republicans and Democrats in the Republican-controlled Congress. In addition, Mr. Trump has vowed to renegotiate NAFTA and pull the U.S. out of a proposed deal among 12 Pacific Rim nations, known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But here again, Mr. Trump may face opposition in Washington from Republican lawmakers who often favor free trade agreements. And what of the promotion of democracy and human rights around the world? While this aspect of U.S. foreign policy was somewhat muted under the Obama administration, the United States has traditionally been viewed as a beacon of hope and liberty for people around the world whose autocratic regimes suppress dissent and freedom of expression, such as Vladimir Putin's Russia, a country with which, it appears, Mr. Trump would like to cultivate warmer ties. Well, with us to discuss foreign policy and national security challenges facing the incoming administration in 2017 are two distinguished analysts. Mark Lagon is Centennial Fellow and Distinguished Senior Scholar at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Previously, he was president of Freedom House, a venerable U.S.-funded institution which promotes democracy and human rights around the world. Mark also served as ambassador at large, directing the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons at the U.S. Department of State. And Daniel Twining, he's director and senior fellow in the Asia program at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. That's a think tank based here in Washington. He has previously served in a variety of senior U.S. foreign policy posts. He was a member of the U.S. Secretary of State's policy planning staff and of the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. He has also served as a foreign policy advisor to Republican Senator John McCain. Both gentlemen join me here on the campus of Georgetown University. Welcome to the program. Well, let me begin with you, Mark Lagon. We are certainly in, I guess some would say, uncharted waters. But as we transition from the Obama presidency, what do you think are some of the most pressing foreign policy and national security challenges facing Donald Trump and his administration as he assumes office this month?
Well, there are three or four major ones. I think the hot spots in the world of the major problems include the Middle East, with a combination of extremists and brittle dictators, some of them allied with the United States, Russia, with designs as at best a spoiler in the international system, and at worst trying to undercut the strength and legitimacy of Western countries, and China, which is really the biggest concern in my mind as a rising power that offers a model that you can grow economically while keeping a lid on civil society. I think we should expect Trump to be very cozy with autocratic allies of the United States by prioritizing an intensive effort on terrorism, perhaps at the expense of human rights. He appears to be much more friendly or at least neutral in his view on Vladimir Putin, which is problematic. And he's quite combative in his rhetoric about China. I'm concerned that he may focus a bit too much on a protectionist economic policy, in fact harming the possibility for the United States developing alliance relations with nations in the region, including on the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
a terrific summary. Let me turn to you, Daniel Twining, for your view on what challenges face President-elect Trump.
Same set of challenges, but maybe I could just frame it with some context. I mean, the Obama handoff to Trump, I think he is handing him a more dangerous and destabilized world, arguably, than any U.S. president in terms of a succession in recent history. And the basic problem we have is that our adversaries have not feared us during the Obama years, and our friends have not been entirely convinced that we had their back and that we were as committed as we have historically been to their security in the case of our allies. I mean, the interesting question is that Trump did not come out of a vacuum. When we talk about foreign policy, many Americans out there who supported him feel like the world is more dangerous and that they believe President Obama bought into this narrative of American decline, which is slightly inaccurate, frankly. President Obama believed in retrenching and bringing home American power and focusing on what he called nation building at home. The result is the greatest refugee crisis since the Second World War coming out of Syria. The result is the return of great power competition from Russia and China. Countries that did not test us really for 20, 25 years are testing us and probing to see how far they can get at our expense. And so the interesting question for Trump, and the answer we don't know, is will he push back on some of these trends?
Well, I'd like to pick up on that and turn back to you, Mark Lagon, with respect to what Daniel Twining said about handing over Mr. Trump a more destabilized world, because many say even with Russia, President Obama perhaps didn't push back enough when he established a so-called red line in Syria. Some saw that perhaps as a green light for Vladimir Putin. Not long after that, he invaded eastern Ukraine and annexed Crimea. So let's take a look at perhaps Obama's legacy and to what extent some of it may unravel, whether it's the Iran nuclear deal, of which he's very proud on the foreign policy front, the pivot to Asia, which may or may not unravel. How do you see this transition? Perhaps more continuity than not?
Well, I think you raise an important point. I think it's distinctly troubling that Trump would view Vladimir Putin as a potential partner. But let's look at what really happened in the Obama tenure. Obsessed with not intervening in countries as the United States had in Iraq and Afghanistan, he was utterly unwilling to take steps in Syria that were in fact in the power of the United States to do good, handed the agenda to Russia, narrowed the aperture of focusing on chemical weapons, and then ended up handing the initiative to Putin. I think that actually led Putin to overreach in Ukraine, and he was left to weigh in with Assad. Now, as for ongoing issues, you raised two. I actually think the Iran nuclear deal was problematic. It was probably tilted towards Tehran. But my own view is that despite his rhetoric, my prediction is that Donald Trump will probably not unravel that deal. On the pivot in Asia, in which the Obama administration had the rhetoric of forming a kind of concert of nations to counterbalance a rising China, the stepping back from a free trade arrangement may be a problem for pursuing the very countering of China that Trump ostensibly is for.
That's a very good point. So the same question to you, Daniel Twining. To what extent Mr. Obama's legacy, you know, might be unraveled, whether it's on the Iran nuclear deal and this pivot to Asia, because we now see Donald Trump wanting to embrace somebody like Vladimir Putin and try to really combat the rise of China. On the other hand, the way in which Mr. Trump would like to combat China perhaps is questionable. Some could even argue that embracing the Trans-Pacific Partnership would be a very important bulwark against China, but because he's so against trade deals, at least for now, that may not convince him.
I mean, I think his administration may need to come back, maybe not to TPP, but to a free trade agenda. I mean, 80% of the American economy, more than that, is not engaged in manufacturing. President-elect seems very focused on bringing manufacturing jobs back home. But these big trade agreements that the Obama administration, with the strong support of congressional Republicans, were trying to push were all about services exports, new tech arrangements, the digital economy. And the Trump agenda doesn't actually encapsulate those, right? So I think there'll be a learning curve. President Obama, by the way, made a deal with labor unions when he was running for president in 2008. The deal was, I will not do a trade agreement during my first term as president, which is how he got the support of the AFL-CIO. That was the deal. And so one great tragedy of TPP is that they They only got to the finish line at the end of President Obama's 8 years. And by then, the politics around it had become very complicated, not just in America, but elsewhere. So America is a free trading nation. I think on the foreign policy question, we could see some continuity. Various other presidents have tried resets with Russia. President Obama tried one. It didn't work out very well. Various other presidents have tried reaching out to dictators. President Nixon tried that with China. Arguably, that worked tactically for a time, but you see where we are with China today. So it may be that the president does try some innovations, but falls back on some of the more enduring trends in American policy.
Well, we will see, talk about some of President-elect Trump's cabinet appointments and also revisit this question of trade vis-a-vis China in particular, to what extent any of his advisors might tell him that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is actually a tool to contain China, the very thing he would like to do. But first, you're listening to Encounter at the Voice of America. My guests are Mark Lagon. He's former president of Freedom House, currently Centennial Fellow, and distinguished senior scholar at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, and Daniel Twining. He's director and senior fellow in the Asia program at the German Marshall Fund of the United States, a think tank based here in Washington. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook via Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to Monza Enoch. He's from Chad. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Mark Lagon. Let's talk about some of President-elect Trump's cabinet appointments, his nominees, to what extent they give us a sense of where he's going on the foreign policy, national security front.
Well, despite everything, obviously, one thing is he likes, you know, a strongman approach. I think he may admire strongmen around the world, and he seems to like military and high-level corporate figures. There are some differences between Flynn as his choice for national security advisor, who has a very forward-leaning way of looking at being suspicious of Muslims as terrorists and Islam as an ideological problem, and is rather friendly to Russia. We don't know quite what to expect out of Tillerson. If confirmed, the 41-year veteran of ExxonMobil is not necessarily a figure one would expect to prioritize human rights, ever be in favor of economic sanctions on a proliferator, a terrorism sponsor, or a human rights abuser. Mattis is very well respected as the nominee to run the Pentagon. All nicknames, Mad Dog aside, is very cerebral and well respected, and I think will have a robust view of American leadership in the world.
Daniel Twining, anything to add or subtract with regard to these appointees?
I mean, on Tillerson, this is a guy who's run one of the biggest companies in the world, one of the biggest global companies in the world, and has a global worldview. And to the extent that there are concerns out there about Donald Trump not having a global worldview, I think that will be offset by people like Tillerson, who have spent the last 30-plus years out in the world. These military leaders around Trump, including the National Security Advisor, including the SecDef and others, they take a much more hawkish view of Russia than Donald Trump does. So their internal advice may be a counterweight to some of his instincts to go do a set of deals with Putin. They also take a hawkish view of China and its offense against American interests in places like the South China Sea. So let us see what happens. Arguably, Donald Trump will be a president who really is a chairman of the board and will delegate lots of the big day-to-day and more strategic foreign policy decisions, not just to these people, but also to Vice President-elect Mike Pence, who is a very traditional hawkish Republican from Capitol Hill, who also takes a skeptical view of our adversaries.
Indeed, and it was very clear in the debates running up to the election that his view on Vladimir Putin differed very much from that of Donald Trump. Well, speaking of style, back to you, Mark Lagon, we certainly have a very different style in Donald J. Trump. So we have the substance and then the style. He uses Twitter a lot to announce his views. How is this going to play when he gets to the White House? Will he continue to do that? Is that wise? How do you see that, governing by tweet?
My view is you could just have a thought experiment and imagine there was no such thing as Twitter, and then it would still matter what impulsively Donald Trump said as a visceral reaction publicly, because what President of the United States says, whether it's on Twitter or otherwise, matters a great deal.
I think it can royal markets.
I'm one who has always argued that we shouldn't just be strategic, but to think about universal values and the liberal international order. So I've sometimes been critical of realpolitikers who didn't think so much about those issues. The question is whether Donald Trump is even a, you know, garden variety realist, or whether he really thinks about deals in very short-term respects. I was myself appalled when he said that he spoke with the president of Taiwan, which I think is reasonable since Taiwan is a democratic country in my own view. He said, however, you know, that he would not be dictated to by China about who he could talk to. However, if a deal could be cut on trade and currency, perhaps that would be different. I don't think that's necessarily a strategic approach.
Back to you, Daniel Twining, governing by tweet. I mean, the indication is his press secretary indicates that he will continue to use Twitter. How is this going to affect his governing style and substance?
He has, what, 25 million followers. It's a very direct way to connect with his people out in the country. We've already seen him move Congress on this ethics office that congressional Republicans wanted to abolish over the objections of the congressional Republican leadership. And Trump tweeted out that this was a crazy idea, and they withdrew the motion. I think what a big question for us is the extent to which, again, the kind of the bureaucratic systems that run the day-to-day life of the country in foreign and domestic policy will tick along versus the extent to which government officials will actually follow the Trump Twitter feed to know what U.S. policy is. Again, it may be that Trump has a strong set of views, but on a limited set of issues. You get beyond some of these issues he really personally cares about, draining the swamp. Things tick along in a more normal way. He's our first president really living in this digital economy, social media age, who was really fueled by it, even more than Barack Obama was. To a certain extent, he has mastered the art of communicating in this new age much better than every other politician.
Back to you, Mark Lagon, to pick up on a topic that you just raised, and that, of course, is China-Taiwan, and the fact that Mr. Trump, you know, wants to perhaps challenge this so-called One China policy, which has been policy for decades now. Are you worried about that?
Well, one reason you could acknowledge that Taiwan is a successful democracy is believing in democracy and believing in Taiwan offering a model and China having a disturbing governance model. That's clearly not the reason that is driving Donald Trump. Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, whatever you think of the details of their foreign policy, were deeply committed to the notion of democracy spreading in the world. And President Obama has stepped back a bit from it. And I think Trump is going farther to focus on other issues besides those. I think it is reasonable not to continue with the fiction that Taiwan doesn't exist and the United States shouldn't observe it. I'm not quite sure whether it can deftly be used or justly be used as a bargaining chip.
How do you see, Daniel Twining, the questioning by Donald Trump of this One China policy?
So it may be time to have a new look at this. I mean, these old unwritten and written set of understandings from the Nixon administration, that was a different age, and China was a different place then, right? China is now a rival and peer competitor to the United States. It's going to emerge as the world's biggest economy and biggest military. So it's fine to have a new look at this. I mean, on the broader point, America is safer when people around the world are free and live in free societies, and rulers who do not respect the rights of their people at home will not respect the rights of other countries abroad. And so support for democracy and liberal values and open societies is a source of security for the United States. And as Mark says, many American presidents have figured this out. I'm hopeful that the president-elect will figure this out too. I mean, President Obama arguably did not particularly ever figure this out in all the deals he did with dictatorships in Iran, in Cuba, in Myanmar. So let's see. Last point on China, though. China itself needs to have a hard look at the fact that people, not just in Taiwan, Chinese societies in Taiwan, in Hong Kong, inside China itself, in Tibet and Xinjiang, want greater degrees of personal and political freedom.
Back to you, Mark Lagon. Very briefly, what about relations between the White House and the Republican-controlled Congress, given differences between Donald Trump and some of the leaders in the Republican Party on issues like Vladimir Putin's Russia, China, and other areas where there may be contention?
We'll have to wait and see. There are some very clear voices like Senator McCain and his ally, Senator Lindsey Graham, sort of reminding the American public and the incoming president of strategic priorities, including skepticism about Russia. But we need to see. At the moment, it appears like the House Republicans, want to follow the person who, won the election, at least in the Electoral College. And I think it's inevitable there'll be some differences over foreign policy. But I worry about incentives leading Republicans, particularly in the House of Representatives, to follow Trump transactionalism.
How do you see that, Daniel Twining, relations?
People did not vote for Donald Trump because he wants to have a cozy relationship with Vladimir Putin. They voted for Donald Trump. You go out and talk to people in the country because they want to shake up Washington, juice the economy, get things going again in America. His mandate is domestic. Americans understand, I think, and have a clear-headed view of who our friends are in the world and who are not. And I actually have a lot of confidence in our Republicans in Congress and also, frankly, in lots of Democrats in Congress. I was up on Capitol Hill a couple weeks ago and people said, look, if a new President Trump on his first day of office lifts sanctions against Russia from the White House, we'll just write them into law here on Capitol Hill. Congressional leaders like Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan preceded Donald Trump into national office, and they will still be around, quite likely, when he leaves national office. And so some of these congressional leaders take a longer view. And I think the longer view is one that reflects America's interest in a rather skeptical relationship with Moscow, given its predatory behavior in Europe.
Indeed. Well, to close, back to you, Mark Lagon, and back to a topic which is near and dear to your heart as former president of Freedom House, and that is the fact that the United States is seen as a beacon of democracy around the world, a defender of the rule of law, freedom of expression. To what extent are you a bit concerned, given some statements by Mr. Trump? He refers to the press as corrupt, lying, and perhaps will go even further than President Obama by not really promoting democracy. How do you see this particular pillar of U.S. policy going forward under President
Trump?
Well,
I admire my colleague Dan Twining for thinking that there'll be continuities and that the American public and Republican legislators will pull us back to the consensus we have. But the evidence is pretty clear that Donald Trump does not prioritize freedom of expression, freedom from corruption. He seems to admire strong men. When you see consolidation of power by Erdogan in Turkey, you should be concerned. He's not. He admires it. When you see Saudi Arabia being an appalling human rights abuser, the United States should rethink its relationship. Donald Trump will not. But the United States has a remarkable ability for political renewal. And so in the long run, I suspect these characteristics of American support for democracy and free expression in the world may transcend Trump.
Well, the last word to you, Daniel Twining, on that very issue, and let me quote the world chess champion and human rights advocate, Garry Kasparov, who says Obama's foreign policy was a catastrophe because he abandoned U.S. values and allies. Embracing Putin's Russia versus NATO and the EU is even worse.
Look, the strength of America does not reside in who sits in the White House. That person comes and goes. I mean, frankly, not every president we have had has been a Nobel Peace Prize level person. You look at some of these presidents 100 years ago, many of whose names one barely remembers, and the republic survived and thrived. The strength of America lies in its people, in its dynamism, in its innovation and frontier spirit, and I think we can survive this too. I also think the president will discover when he takes office that the world looks very different from the Oval Office than it does from a tower in Manhattan.
Well, on that cautiously optimistic note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests and hosts here at Georgetown University, Mark Lagon, former president of Freedom House, now distinguished senior scholar at Georgetown University, and Daniel Twining, director and senior fellow in the Asia program at the German Marshall Fund. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your terrific insights.
Thanks for having us.
A delight.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer and producer was Gary Jaffe. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.